plunge into the study itself. I promise you, brethren, I think, no other class that I teach in the next 6 months is going to be as dry and technical and just difficult as this one is tonight. So please don't make any decisions about whether or not you want to be here for next Wednesday night based on this evening. It is just work that you have to do. So I've never enjoyed packing for a trip. I know you don't either. If you're going to go on a hike and you have to think about all the things, you know, you have to get in order to make that happen. Beautiful as it is to be out in the country and all of that, you know, you just have to do some preparation work. And I really don't know any way to get around it. We can't just ignore it. It is too important. And yet, it really is difficult when you're dealing with when the book was written. Every commentary you read is going to start off with this right at the very beginning. Your understanding of the book will be really determined, which I don't mean you'll know what the symbols mean, but you will be on one fork of a big road depending on what you decide with regard to when the book of Revelation was written. So if you pick the late date, then it is determined that you will not see the city of Jerusalem in this book. That is because, if you'll turn to Revelation chapter 1 and look at the first three verses, it says, "The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his bondservants the things which must shortly take place. And he sent and communicated it by his angel to his bondservant John, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ to all that he saw. Blessed is he who reads, and those who hear the words of the prophecy, and heed the things which are written in it, for the time is near." Well, now, obviously, brethren, if this book is written after the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, about which we'll have much to say for months to come, if the book was written after Jerusalem was encircled, besieged, starved out, attacked, violently destroyed by the Romans in 66 through 70 AD, a 3.5-year siege, if the city is destroyed in 70 AD and this book is written 25 years later, then it can't be talking about something that's 25 years in the past, can it? Not according twice, verse 1 and verse 3, as you start the book. So, if, though, you pick as a date for Revelation an earlier date that precedes the fall of Jerusalem, well then, at least, it is a possibility that the symbols in the book are talking about the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So, like it or not, we've got to wrestle with this. Now, before you know, you see a copy, and I've got one right here. Let me pull these out. This is the revised edition. Just not very long at all before Homer passed away. This is an earlier edition. First came out in 1979. If one of you would like to have this commentary, first come, first serve, it's free. I bought, you know, the upgraded version too, so again, don't hesitate. But this is Homer Haley's commentary on the book of Revelation. This is the way that I taught Revelation twice before 1987. This view from Homer, whose picture's on the back side here, I thought was the best that I'd ever found. I read, you know, quite a few commentaries on Revelation, but this seemed to do the best job to my way of thinking prior to 1987. In his introductory material, like everybody else, he addresses this question of the dating of the book. So the next three quotes that you're going to see will be coming from pages 26 and 27 in this particular edition right here. Homer says, "Scholars have periodically debated the date for John's receiving and recording the revelation, but the choice usually lies between the time of Nero, AD 64 to 68, and the time of Domitian, AD 91 to 96. Now, there are other dates that are given. Some will think it might be, you know, a little bit earlier on this one. Some will say, you know, maybe a little earlier or later on that one. But those are really the two dates. And this is the way it has been, brethren, for the last couple of hundred years. We are debating, we're trying to decide when was the book written between these two major views. And everybody else that's reading Revelation is doing exactly the same thing. Here's another quote a little bit later on the same page. A formidable array of illustrious names who defend the Neronian date, which is commonly called the early date, could be set over against an equally reputable and scholarly host of defenders of the Domitian date. But this array of names would not resolve the question. After considering arguments for each of the positions, I believe that the weight of evidence favors the late date, AD 91 to 96. Though there are some strong but inconclusive arguments for the Neronian. Brethren, that is so fair. That is so honest. It's just so forthright. He falls down on the late date, though he knows the other arguments are strong. I fall down on the early date. People falling down everywhere you look. But, you know, we all recognize that whichever you pick, there are very reasonable, valid, defensible reasons for making your choice. And consequently, the entire scholarly world, of which I think Homer Haley, one of the greatest that's ever lived, has been debating this, and there is just an array of names that are appropriately calling somewhere illustrious in here, you know, on both sides of this issue. It is not going to be resolved by picking the names of the scholars. The finest scholars that have ever lived in and out of the Lord's church have debated this for a couple of centuries now. Third quote, Philip Schaff, who I hope you'll know and should know if you don't, who accepts and defends the earlier date, has said of John's exile to Patmos and the disputed date, should be any other, quote, external evidence points to the reign of Domitian, AD 95. Internal evidence to the reign of Nero, or soon after his death, AD 68. Now, this is Homer again, who takes the late date, pointing out that Philip Schaff, who is arguably the greatest historian of Christianity ever. Philip Schaff's work on the history of the Christian church, which originally came in 8 volumes, you can get in some single volume kind of approaches. But originally, you know, there were 8 volumes in this. This is page 427 in the first volume. They're huge volumes. This man, by most people, is just revered as the single best historian to record the history from the time of Jesus up until about, 75 years ago, just there ever was. And this quote, which is found in Homer's book, I think, is profoundly important, because that's the same conclusion that I reached, that the external evidence, that is, evidence and arguments that are not principally found in the book, but are derived from other sources outside the book, favor the reign of Domitian about AD 95 being the time when John wrote the book of Revelation. Internal evidence, arguments and reasons that you can see in the book itself, would lead or support the reign of Nero, or soon after his death, maybe AD 68. That is something to think about. Because it's really quite true. This is what Philip Schaff said. Homer agrees with it. I agree with it. Now, that doesn't mean automatically that my view of an early date must necessarily be right, because most of the evidence for my view comes from within the book. It doesn't mean necessarily that the late date must be wrong, because most of its evidence comes from outside the book. It just is something to think about for this reason. If, brethren, you approach this book by saying, I must first determine when was it written, and that after I have made my mind up on when it was written, I will then read the book and see if I can understand what it means, I think that would be a profound mistake. In my view, we should be reading the book first with a blank slate, so that we take all the biases and prejudices and preconceived notions and conclusions off the table. It renders us more receptive to all of the possible ideas. So what I always counsel people is, look, I'm going to start my class with this. We're going to work over it, you know. But when you're done, all the scholars in the world are not going to solve the question for you because they're pretty evenly divided on both sides. But as we look at the book itself, I believe the approach that I take is stronger because not only do I find internal evidence from when it was written for an early date, but if I allow Jerusalem as a possibility, which I didn't at first, I started with Homer, I taught it twice that way, you know, at least I'm allowing myself to consider whether or not the book can be teaching that. And I think if you do, you'll come away recognizing, I certainly did after studying it for quite a few years, I changed my mind, that the book then, teaching about the fall of Jerusalem, must have been written prior to the fall of Jerusalem, because the book is about things that will shortly come to pass. That's the approach I think will be most helpful. But it's impossible, and I'm not going to do it tonight. So here we go. Yes, you do. You have to consider it. If it is absolutely undeniable that the book was written in the 90s, then is it talking about the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD? Well, no, it's not. You know, it's as simple as can be. And so, if it could be proven that it was written in the 90s, then I concede my case and I'll go back to teaching something else. I'll figure something else out or I'll teach the way I did in the past, but I'm going to have to give up if it can be proven. My point in reading all these quotes from Homer is that every other scholar is going to tell you exactly the same thing. It's really tough to figure out when the date, you know, when the book was written. So, let's go through and talk about it. We're going to operate at kind of scholarly level. We're going to deal with stuff, you know, that may be kind of dry and technical, but let's get it all out. You know, and then you can be reading, you can be thinking about it, you know, both sides, as we then get deeper into the book to see what it's talking about. Now, as you've seen, there's really only two choices, an early date and a late date, which both sides falls within a range of a couple of years. All right. Please open your Bibles, Revelation chapter 1 and verse 10, and in verse 13, and in chapter 2, verse 10, and in chapter 6, verses 9 through 11, and chapter 13 and verse 7. Take a pick, read any one you want. I'm not going to read any of them, because I need to save the time. We've got a lot to cover here this evening. But when you get to those passages, take any one you like. There is persecution of God's people taking place. There is suffering and attacks and all kinds of issues going on where Christians, the saints, are being persecuted. This persecution is an evidence for us about when the book might have been written. It will help us to determine, at least, it's important to think about it, is this persecution Roman persecution? Is the persecution in the book instigated by the Roman Empire and by the Caesars? Or is that persecution, attributed to Domitian? Domitian would be the emperor that most people say was reigning when Rome really got to persecuting the saints. So they argue from external evidence in the uninspired historical records about persecution of Christians, which Philip Schaff will tell you about, they will argue that it's a Roman persecution that the book's talking about, and that doesn't get started until the 90s. So it can't be talking about the fall of Jerusalem. It's got to be talking about something after that. Now, my answer to that, of course, is one I think you all recognize from your book of Acts. What persecution began and was sustained throughout the whole book of Acts? Was it Jewish or was it Roman? When the book of Acts closes, you have 30 years of the church's history, and the Romans are still trying to get rid of this problem. They don't want to persecute the Christians. It's just a thorn in their side, a constant problem, because the Jews threw a fit, pitched a riot, made some threats, and forced the Romans to kill Jesus, and continue to pitch their fit and force the Romans to have to deal with Peter and James and John and Paul. The Jewish persecution began an awful lot sooner than Domitian as a Roman. And the Jewish persecution, brethren, you can read about it in the Thessalonian letter. You can read about it in Peter's letters. It is an empire-wide problem. Wherever there were Jews, they were opposing and persecuting saints. They didn't want to buy into Christianity. So if the saints are being persecuted, and the book doesn't say, by Caesar, at least we ought to keep our minds open. You know, it just might be talking about all those decades where, from the beginning, the Jews were rejecting their Messiah. And by the way, even if you pick a Roman persecution, it has long surprised me that people say, well, if it's a Roman persecution, it must be under the reign of Domitian. Why? Because in all the history books, whether they are religious or secular, everybody readily admits that the first Roman persecutor was Nero, not Domitian. He killed Christians in large numbers. He did. Now, arguments come back, and I understand this, brethren. Those of you that hold to a late date, I know you have a handful of answers to my answers, to which I have answers, and you have answers, and there are answers. Okay? So you start off on this, and believe me, whole books have been written on the topic, and I'm going to recommend one for you before the night is over. So, please, you know, I'm not being unfair here to anybody. I really don't want to be. I just want you to know at two levels. There's an argument for this. There's a counter-argument for this as well. Make sure you read both sides, because I know the first time, two times I taught the book, I didn't. I only bought this. The commentaries I read, you know, said this. So I accepted this. It seemed solid. That's what the scholars were saying. I didn't know there were 50% of them on the other side yet. So I bought this. Couldn't find Jerusalem anywhere in there. Read the book, you know, leaving Nero, his persecution, and the Jewish persecution before it completely out of the picture. Maybe that might be a mistake. Now, everybody look at Revelation chapter 13. First four verses says, he stood on the sand of the seashore, and I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns were 10 diadems, on his heads were blasphemous names, and the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power and his throne and great authority, and I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed, and the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. And they worshipped the dragon because he gave his authority to the beast. And they worship the beast, saying, who is like the beast? And who is able to wage war with him? So, we have this beast, which apparently represents some sort of empire, and they're worshiping him. Under the figures of beast and all this other, you know, about, what would this be, about 17 weeks, we'll get to chapter 13, you know. But most people say, well, okay, Domitian is the first emperor who required that he be worshipped. And I bought this. I saw it in all the commentaries. So I said, okay, then that's the case. That's a strong external argument for a late date. Because Philip Schaff and the other historians tell us that emperor worship didn't begin to, until Domitian in the 90s. But was it so? See, not till some years went by and I started delving into this more deeply did I discover that there's an answer to that. Did I discover, for instance, that 195 years before Jesus was born, there was a temple that was dedicated to Dea Roma in Smyrna, which is one of the cities that this book is addressed to. Dea Roma is the idea that the empire itself is a deity, and so are its emperors. And they had a temple worshiping the god Rome 195 years before Jesus was even born. So to say we don't have emperor worship and we don't have empire worship, I was going to put both of these on there and thought the lettering would be too small, but emperor slash empire worship is what the symbol is apparently talking about. We'll get to it when we get there. See, that's been going on for over 280 years. Nero himself proclaimed himself to be a divinity, brethren, and it is not arguable. So, we say, well, yeah, you know, he did that, but not like the omission, and it took a different form, or it was more limited. You know, okay, so all, you know, all the argumentation begins. But just at level one, there's an argument for, yes, the omission was a persecutor. The late date, there's an argument for the early date. There's a counter-argument, brethren, just every time. Revelation chapters 2 and 3 we are not going to read tonight. You've all read them many times. You know there's seven churches that are addressed there. You know a great deal of personal information about those churches is revealed. Argument is often made that, and again, this has largely to do with external evidence. We read about these churches in other places. It's thought, well, if Revelation was written in the 60s, those seven churches would have been too young to be described this way. And chief among those arguments is Ephesus, which in chapter 2 is that first church. So turn over to chapter 2. Chapter 2. Now again, I'm not going to read it all. This church is addressed in verses 1 through 7. I just want to pick out verse 4, because it's where most people camp and make their strongest argument. It says, I have this against you, that you have left your first love. So the argument goes like this. Well, if the book is written in 68 AD, then Ephesus is maybe only 10 or 15 years old. How can they have lost its first love in such a short time? Now, I bought this, brethren. Honest people do this, sincere people do this. And I thought, oh, yeah, no, that sounds good. Then I got to thinking about Galatia. What did Paul say to the Galatian brethren? Not long at all, a couple of years after those churches got started. Lot shorter than 10, half of 10. What did he say to Galatia? You're so soon removed from him who called you, and he just blisters them for chapters. He was so unhappy. What about the Corinthians? Did they not have any problems? Could they not be described, you know, as having lost their first love? Well, they were rejecting the resurrection. And so, at first, I thought, okay, well, the historians, you know, they know, and as we put this together, you know, the Bible scholars, these churches could never be described this way. It just doesn't fit. But as I went back, brethren, and spent hours thinking about it, why, of course it could fit. There are other churches doing the same thing and being described elsewhere in your Bible exactly like all seven of those are. So there's your answer. Why not? You know, I think it's just a presumption. It's just an assumption that we don't think they could be described that way. Well, I'm reading a book that says they are, and I don't know when the book was written, but the scholars are evenly divided, and I can find references to churches those ages that are like this. So sure I could. Sure I could. Look at Revelation chapter 13 again, and a little bit later now, verse 18. We read the first four verses. Now we come down to verse 18, the one verse in the entire book that everybody knows about, that everybody loves. Revelation 13:18. Here's wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast. Here we go again, you know, with these beasts. For the number is that of a man, and his number is 666. It's kind of like you can't say Voldemort. Okay. People are really like, you know, you should be afraid of it. If you had that on your license plate, you know, you'd be afraid of getting car crashes or something. Okay, well, all right. 666. 666 here is the number of the beast. Who's it referring to? Now, this next argument for external evidence, brethren, is the single most powerful, favorite one of all for the late date. All the books I've read, people I've talked to through the years, this is it. This is the big boy. When was the book written? Irenaeus. Irenaeus. However you pronounce his name, I was never sure. He lived from about 130 to 202, so about 70-some years. Now, Irenaeus is pretty famous in church history. He's not a Bible writer, Very famous guy, though. He lives, 100 years after Jesus returned to heaven. He wrote about 180 to 190, so he's writing about 150 years after the resurrection. Then his book is lost, and he's quoted by a guy named Eusebius about 300 AD. So you got two names, Irenaeus and Eusebius. Eusebius says that Irenaeus said, so you're going to get secondhand information, and you're going to get information that's about 200 and some odd years old. Irenaeus, supposedly, I'm sure he did, Eusebius is quoting him, said this. Now, this is huge, but to get it all on the screen, I had to make it small. That's why I keep encouraging everybody to come sit over here and right in front, so you can read all this. But this is the quote that Brethren has just endlessly debated and has been for the longest time at the highest levels of scholarship in biblical studies. Here's what Eusebius said that Irenaeus said. Quote, if it were necessary to have his name distinctly announced at the present time, it would doubtless have been announced by him who saw the apocalypse. It's a commentary on Revelation 13:18. And they're going, what's the man represented by the number? Who's 666? And Eusebius says that as Irenaeus was discussing that, he wrote, if it were necessary to have his name distinctly announced at the present time, it would doubtless have been announced by him who saw the apocalypse. If it was necessary at the present time to have his name distinctly announced, he wouldn't put 666. He would have said, it's, and he would have told us. Next phrase in the same sentence. For it was not a great while ago that it is the way it's usually translated from the Greek. That it, not he, was seen. But almost in our own generation, toward the end of Domitian's reign. Whoa. For an uninspired quote, which is therefore external evidence, where men who are devoted to the Bible in the very early centuries are talking about this very passage, we've got a statement here that is about that and would tell us something about when the book was written. If it were necessary to have his name distinctly announced at the present time, it would doubtless have been announced by him who saw the apocalypse. For it was not a great while ago that the apocalypse was seen, but almost in our own generation toward the end of Domitian's reign. If you translate the Greek with the word it, then the sentence reads, it was not a great while ago that the book of Revelation, that the symbols, that the visions, were seen. But they were seen almost in our own generation toward the end of Domitian's reign, the 90s. So, if you translate it, if Eusebius believed that Irenaeus said that it was written toward the end of Domitian's reign. Now, let's suppose that that's the proper way to translate this. Would that still be the undeniable truth? Is it inspired? Could it be a mistake? Yeah. It's strong evidence. It's powerful evidence. It's convincing evidence. When I believed it, I believed it firmly. I believed it honestly. But then, I spent 5 years studying Greek myself at a college level, Will Williams and another teacher before him. I did both beginning and intermediate studies on a college level, the Greek language. And you know what I found out? They don't do these pronouns like we do in English. In fact, they don't even have those words. What they do is they have a word, and then depending on the ending, it could mean he, she, or it. But it could mean any one of those three, and only the context will tell you. So, unlike our language, which saw the ambiguity in that, we went and admitted he, she, and it. Now we've got several words, and they have gender attached to them, so that we put them in, and then you can't have this question right here, should it be translated, it was seen, or should it be translated, he was seen? Which is it? commentaries I read, nobody ever addresses this. Quite a few do. But a lot of them just don't. They say, here it is. Said it. So it, the revelation, was seen at the end of Domitian's reign. That's when John saw it. But it could be translated he. And any Greek scholar will agree. Of course it could be he. It could be she. So is it it or he? There doesn't seem to be a she involved. Is it it or he? Well, friends, I want you to think about that statement. If you read Revelation 13:18 and you wonder, who is 666? And then the answer comes. If it were necessary to have his name distinctly announced at the present time, it would doubtless have been announced by him who saw the apocalypse. It would doubtless have been announced by what? Him who saw. It would be announced by him who saw it. John saw it, and he wrote what he saw. What he saw was 666. He wasn't given the name. If he knew what the name was, he wasn't even allowed to write it down. But maybe he would have been free to tell us. So, if it was necessary, it would have been announced by him. Not by the book. The book's the problem. The book's what we don't understand. To clarify the book, which we don't understand, we're going to ask who? The book? We ask him. What does the book mean? Who saw the apocalypse? For it was not a great while ago that he was seen, but almost in our own generation toward the end of Domitian's reign. So, a perfectly valid and only way to determine is by context, way to translate this sentence, is that if you want to know what the 666 represents, you'd ask John, because he lived all the way down in Domitian's reign. Does it make any sense at all, brethren, to be confused about what is written, to want to know what the 666 means, so you would consult the book because it was written down toward Domitian's reign? It's talking about him. You ask him. This is a far better translation. And it changes everything, doesn't it? It changes everything. So, when I came across that, I really had to backtell. Why didn't you believe that? I didn't even know that. Now that I do know that, then I see there's equally valid ways to translate it, and it makes more sense to me, at least, that it would be this would be he, because it's following this him. That's the theme. What? That's the end of the most powerful external statement we have about when the book is written. It just vaporizes. That doesn't solve the problem. Now, show me some internal evidence for why. In the book of Revelation, we've already read 1 through 3. So turn to chapter 22. Go to the last chapter now. Chapter 22, and I've done this several times in various lessons here recently, so I know you're familiar with this. Verse 6 says, "He said to me, these words are faithful and true, and the Lord, the God of the spirits of the prophets, sent his angel to show those bondservants the things which must shortly take place. And behold, I'm coming quickly. Blessed is he who heeds the words of the prophecy of this book. And I, John, am the one who heard and saw these things. And when I heard and saw, I fell down to worship at the feet of the angel who showed me these things. And he said to me, do not do that. I am a fellow servant of yours and of the brethren, the prophets, and of those who heed the words of this book. Worship God. And he said to me, do not seal up the words of the prophecy of this book, for the time is near. Now skip down to verse 12. Behold, I am coming quickly, and my reward is with me to render to every man according to what he has done. And verses 20 and 21. He who testifies to these things says, yes, I am coming quickly. Amen. Come, Lord Jesus. The grace of the Lord Jesus be with you all. Amen. Now, brother, internally, the book says these events are going to take place soon in the first three verses and quickly and near in the first three and at the end of the book. What are you going to do with that? A lot of study that we'll come to in another class, because I don't have time for it tonight. But we're going to be looking for something that's in the near future, aren't we? Not the far future. We're looking for the things to be fulfilled in the near future. Now, in Revelation 13:18, which we've already read, whose name is the number? When we get there, we'll spend an enormous amount of time on this. So I'm just going to tell you, Then I'll show you when we get to chapter 13. This comes up there. Neron is one of the two common spellings of this man Nero at the time he was living. It was spelled both ways. The letters have numbers assigned to them, very closely akin to your Roman numerals. The study of Roman numerals, or any other names that represent numbers, or numbers represented by names, is called gematria. The study of numbers, called gematria, knows that Neron's spells 666. But there's something really curious. We'll spend a lot more time on this later. Did you know that some of the manuscripts of Revelation don't have 666 at all? Most people don't even know that. And quite a few good manuscripts that have 616. They don't have 666. It's 616. Very few people even know that. Well, we've got a translation problem because we've got a textual problem. There are texts that say different things. Which one's right? Well, isn't it interesting that the other common spelling is 616? And now we have an explanation for why we have that textual problem. Oh, what one name would fit both? Only Nero. That at least ought to be considered, don't you think, Ben? That ought to be something that you chew on for a while. Why do we have a textual variant? And what does it mean that Nero fits both of them? Domitian doesn't add up that way. Revelation chapter 17. Now, we're going to have two different things that we'll look at here in Revelation 17, and again, admittedly, you know, you're digging into past history and all that. But in verses 9 through 11, here's the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits, and they are seven kings. Heads are mountains are kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other is not yet come, and when he comes, he must remain a little while, and the beast which was and is not is himself also an eighth, and is one of the seven, and he goes to destruction. Trust me, we'll spend a lot of time when we get there. It's just an introduction. So all kinds of things come to mind. You know, I know you're curious. I'm not going to deal with any of that. Just to say, Josephus wrote a book called The Antiquities of the Jews. He was born about the year Jesus died, and he lived to see with his own eyes the fall of Jerusalem in those years, 66 to 70 AD. In Antiquities, and it's divided into first books itself, the big books divided into small books, and then in chapters, and then in paragraphs. So they don't have verse references the way they did in Josephus. But in book 18, chapter 2, and in paragraph 2, it says this. Before we do that, if the heads are kings, then we need to find five that are fallen, and then one that is, and then one that's coming, and then an eighth. So we're going to have to spend a lot of time in history thinking about kings, what kings Revelation might be talking about, especially to seven churches in Asia. What would they think of when they thought about kings? How do we start counting? Now, brethren, almost, I guess, without any exception, when everybody reads 17, 9 through 11, they say, okay, these have to be contemporary kings to the seven churches in chapters 2 and 3. They'll know who they are. These kings would represent something to these people, and so the book was given to them. They're supposed to heed it. What would they get out of it? What would they start looking for, you know, for kings? So, I guess, without exception, everybody says, it's emperors. It's Roman emperors. It's got to be emperors. It's emperors. I say it's emperors. Everybody I know says it's emperors. Homer Haley, everybody thinks it's emperors. Now we're going to read this quote. When do we start counting? Josephus, who's an eyewitness of the fall of Jerusalem, he said, in a list of emperors, after him came Annius Rufus, under whom died Caesar, the second emperor of the Romans. The duration of whose reign was 57 years, besides 6 months and 2 days. Well, it's not hard at all to know how Josephus counted kings. When you're talking about the Caesars, Josephus said that this Caesar is the second emperor of the Romans, and the second emperor reigned for 57-6 plus. Which emperor reigned for 57-6 plus? Augustus. They're all going to use the name Caesar, but then they have a secondary name, or primary as you decide, but it was Augustus that reigned that long. In the time of the apostles, and in the very time that the book of Revelation was written, a first century Jew who was a Pharisee, he thought that the second emperor was Augustus. That's what the Jews were thinking in the first century. Upon whose death, Tiberius Nero, his wife Julia's son, succeeded. He was now the third emperor. And then, same thing, continuing the same place. So when Tiberius had at this time appointed Caius to be his successor, he outlived but a few days and then died after he had held the government 22 years, 5 months, and 3 days, and Caius was the fourth emperor. We know what first century Jews thought was the proper numbering for Caesars. Caius, also called Gaius, is Caligula. But what does that mean to us, brethren? What that means is that these people in the time and the Jewish people thought that Julius Caesar was the first emperor. Julius, after whom all the rest are named, where Caesar appears, are all called Caesar, was named after Julius Caesar. And he said, Julius is the first, Augustus is the second, Tiberius is the third, then we have, he goes right down the list. Today, when people look at these kings, those who take the late date count Augustus as the first emperor. And in so doing, everything changes in chapter 17 on what you think it means. So if you count Augustus as the first, then we're going to go on down through time well beyond the fall of Jerusalem. But if you count Caesar as the first, everything changes, and Jerusalem becomes a very prominent possibility. That's powerful evidence, brethren, to think about. It is wrong that I've got internal. It's right that it comes out of this passage, but it's external in the sense that it's Josephus. See how they both go together. But that's huge, because it is a very viable thought that we might count the kings the way the first century Jews did and not the way we do 2,000 years later. That, I think, is food for thought. In chapter 11, verses 1 and 2. Chapter 11, verses 1 and 2. How many of you read all that material I mailed to the Mormon? You Mormon followers. Okay, quite a few. You would have seen this. In 11, chapter 1 and 2, verses 1 and 2 rather, there was given me a measuring rod like a staff, and someone said, rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and those who worship in it, and leave out the court which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it's been given to the nations, and they will tread underfoot the holy city for 42 months. Okay. I'm looking for the holy city to be given to the nations and trodden underfoot for 42 months. Is it just a coincidence that that's the exact length of time of the Roman siege? From 66 to 70. Now look at Luke chapter 21. In Luke 21, in verses 20 through 24, which I quoted to the Mormon that I was responding to. 21:20. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is at hand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are in the midst of the city depart, and let not those who are in the country enter the city, because these are days of vengeance, in order that all things which are written may be fulfilled. Woe to those who are with child and to those who nurse babes in those days, for there will be great distress upon the land and wrath to this people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Now you come back to Revelation 11:2. Leave out the court which is outside the temple and do not measure it, for it's been given to the nations, and they will tread underfoot the holy city for 42 months. Did you know the word nations here and the word Gentiles in Luke 21 is the same word? The same word. And the length of the siege was 42 months. Wow. But of course we know that Revelation cannot be talking about the fall of Jerusalem because it was written 25 years later. We might think it was written 25 years later, but what if the book tells us something else? Well, maybe we ought to lay aside our preconceived notion about when it was written to think about what it says. In 11, again, same chapter, look at verse 8. In 11:8, their dead bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which mystically is called Sodom in Egypt, where also their Lord was crucified. What city are we talking about? Now, what does the symbol mean? Well, that's arguing. Who are these two guys, and what does it mean they're dead? And you know, we'll have to study that when we get to chapter 11. But whatever that symbol means, I know a city was being represented in the vision. The city that he was talking about was Jerusalem. Now, did this not have any reference to Jerusalem? And it really meant Rome. I mean, it was just, you know, mystical, like Sodom and Egypt. Hard for me to go that way. I think it might be talking about Jerusalem more than just in vision, but what the vision meant was also about Jerusalem. Now, this is my last slide, so we actually went faster than I thought it would tonight. Okay. You ever hear of a little country called Syria? That's all you hear about on the news right now, right? How many of you watched Barack Obama last night, you know, give his speech? I sure did. Tune right in, very interested in all of that, you know, here we go again, and what are we going to do? And big problem, and you know, so what are we going to do about Syria? Syriac means from Syria, or related to Syria. So, next time you think, well, Syria always only bad, here's a good thing, you know, in the Syriac manuscript of the book of Revelation, which comes in the 600s after Jesus. The Syriac manuscript in the 600s just happens to be the oldest extant text of the book of Revelation. We don't have any copy that's older than that. So everything we know about the book of Revelation today, as far as original manuscripts goes back to that one. It's the oldest one we have. Here is the uninspired title on the page that is introducing the book of Revelation in the oldest manuscript that we have. That's what it says. The revelation which was made by God to John the Evangelist in the island Patmos into which he was thrown by, that does not say Domitian. It says Nero. Now, I can take Irenaeus' statement as recorded by Eusebius, and I think more appropriately translated he instead of it, and then it will match this, which came 300 years later. Now, you'll remember when we were studying Psalms, uninspired titles. David, when his son Absalom tried to kill him, uninspired. But it is a historical tradition, and when you read the psalm, you can see how it would really fit. And we even have some psalms that have titles like that confirmed for us in the New Testament, where in the inspired record, it quotes the psalm and says David wrote it. Okay? So, these titles, they're dangerous. Well, what are you going to do with them? They're not inspired. They were added by some uninspired guy. All they reflect is what the uninspired guy was thinking in the 600s, 600 years after Christ, after the book was written. But what does it say? The oldest manuscript we have attributes Patmos and that exile to Nero and not to Domitian. Now, again, there's all kinds of arguments, you know, that you can get into. So, let me recommend a couple of books for you, which I don't have. I have to bring them next week. But I want to put it on the tape here. There is a guy by the name of Kenneth, K-E-N-N-E-T-H, Gentry. As if he were to the manor born. G-E-N-T-R-Y. Kenneth Gentry has written two books, one of which is a must-own. You just have to go buy this book. It is called The Beast of Revelation. The Beast of Revelation. It is a schizophrenic book because it has two totally different books that have just been found under one cover. Paperback, not very expensive. So he calls the one book The Beast of Revelation. And in half the book, he spends half of the whole book talking about 666. So you can go dig and dig, you know, all that information about Revelation 13, 18. Okay. But the other half of the book is his Reader's Digest condensed version of a much larger book that he wrote that has only one topic. When was Revelation written? And he has a compendium there of just every argument I've ever seen. Now, The Beast of Revelation has half of the book dedicated to dealing with all the internal and external evidence about when the book was written. Buy that book. It's a marvel. It's just wonderful. And it tells you about the 666. Very great detail. But if you really want to get into it, the big book is called Before Jerusalem Fell. Before Jerusalem Fell. Kenneth Gentry's work, Before Jerusalem Fell. I've been saying now since, I don't know when, 20 plus years. If you have not read Kenneth Gentry's book, it may not convince you of an early date. But if you have not read it, you have not read everything there is to know about the great debate on when this book was written. It is the fullest account and discussion on the dating of Revelation that I have ever found. And so, if you haven't read that yet, I don't mean to say that you haven't studied and you don't know what you're talking about, and you're certainly wrong. I'm just saying there's information in there that very likely you've not seen before. It's the rest of the story, and it's the other side of the story. It comes from the 50% of the scholars that defend the early date. So here's how I wrap it all up. Brethren, in churches of Christ, the great majority of the saints and their teachers embrace the late date, as did I until 1987, so for about 14 years. Okay? I'm in a minority, but I'm right. Everything else is wrong. I mean, I like to think I have some reason for what I believe. So I challenge you, if you think case closed on when Revelation was written, because after all, Eusebius quoted Irenaeus, and he said it was written during Domitian's reign, you better read this other book first and ask yourself, you know, have I really seen everything there is on this? Now, I know I'm in the minority, but, you know, I wanted to close with this thought. It is an increasing minority. And as a matter of fact, brethren, it's been increasing pretty rapidly. And I think that's really a good thing. So, I don't know what percentage of the Lord's people have accepted this approach. But it has, I've watched it change dramatically when from 87 I felt really alone. You know, to now, I find preachers all the time. I say, oh yeah, you know, that's where I've been for 15 years. I say, I have some friends there. So, that's the deal on dating Revelation. And the toughest stuff we're going to have, I think, you know, bar none, We're going to do some technical stuff still. We'll have, you know, some scholarly stuff that we have to work with, word studies and all. But that really toughest one. So, again, no apologies. You know, come back next week if you think that was kind of dry. And hopefully it won't be quite such a slog. Any comment or question before we close? Yeah, great. Yeah, absolutely. And so all of these old writers who come after Christ and the Bible were men who had made a commitment to being Christians. But you'll find all kinds of really unusual stuff, you know, in what they say. I think it's the one about the same time, might be the same author. He said baptism should be performed three times. In the name of the Father, in the name of the Son, and in the name of the Holy Spirit. Isn't that what the text said? See? Well, we don't do that. Now, is he right or wrong on Revelation because he said something we think is kooky somewhere else? I don't know. See, I don't know. They're uninspired. Okay? Great, quick, I'm over.